Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Julian Zelizer actually had an interesting tweet. He says, it does sort of feel like we're all living in the movie Groundhog Day, but each day the scenario gets worse. I'm personally feeling reassured because we've shut down the border with Canada. But in any case, we are joined the day after the, I don't know what we call it, Super Tuesday 3. We are joined by Jonathan Allen from NBC News, the author of a best-selling book about the 2016 campaign, Shattered. That seems like a kinder and gentler era now, doesn't it, Jonathan?
Yeah, it definitely seems like a smaller era in a way.
It does. It's like, who thought we'd ever be nostalgic for 2019? Okay, so third straight week, Joe Biden doesn't just beat Bernie Sanders. He just blows him out, sweeps Florida, Illinois, and Arizona, would have swept Ohio as well. I'm really struck by how complete the victory is. I mean, it's not just that Bernie Sanders has lost. He's underperformed his 2016 numbers dramatically, and you have Biden winning every kind of state. I mean, from, you know, Mississippi, Washington, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Texas, Virginia, Idaho, and he's winning among just about every other demographic other than young people, you know, Black, white, college educated, non-college, urban, rural, suburban. I guess I was really struck by the fact that Bernie Sanders failed to win a single county in Florida. So I'll ask you the central Wednesday morning question: why is Bernie Sanders still in this race?
You know, I'm not sure what Bernie Sanders' thinking is. I can't get at the thinking, but I do see one potential advantage for Biden in Sanders staying in the race, which is that if Bernie Sanders continues to run and continues to get sort of, you know, hammered into the ground in state after state, perhaps Bernie Sanders' most ardent supporters, the ones who get so angry and believe that everything is rigged against him, and, you know, threaten to and actually do stay home or vote for the Republican candidate come general election time, will actually decide that maybe this was fairly decided, and will not have that anger and will not try to lead the election toward Donald Trump in November, that perhaps the Bernie Sanders movement will flame out. And maybe that's a better outcome for Joe Biden, and maybe it's a better outcome for Bernie Sanders than his support base being disappointed.
See, Jonathan, this is why you're not just another pretty face, because this actually does make a little sense. And when I read your piece this morning, you said, you know, the best way to end the campaign without damaging Biden is a slow and quiet march toward non-competitiveness. So that even the, you know, the hearted hardcore folks just realize, okay, it's over. It is done. On the other hand, we're just a few days away from that that debate on Sunday, where Biden did not look like he was doing a slow and quiet march toward non-competitiveness. I think a lot of people were somewhat startled by how aggressive he was in trying to take down Joe Biden. And you know, Bernie Twitter, and again, Twitter's not the real world, but, you know, has really been savaging Joe Biden. So your explanation is the most rational. I guess, you know, I would have leaned more toward this is a vanity run from somebody that frankly just doesn't, you know, give a shit about whether he's going to be damaging Democratic chances in November.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's hard to get inside someone else's head. It may be that both things are true. And I, you know, look, I think Bernie's under a lot of pressure. Bernie Sanders is under a lot of pressure from his support base to fight this thing. He was aggressive against Joe Biden, but he also was really ineffective against Joe Biden. I mean,
yeah,
he's not making good arguments even for his platform, which is very disappointing to people who agree with him but are not necessarily big fans of his.
Yeah, you point out, by the way, that that the vast majority of Democratic voters trusted Biden to handle a crisis more than they trusted Sanders. In Florida, 71% of voters picked Biden, 64% in Illinois, 63% in Arizona. One of the strongest hits, obviously, that the Sanders was leveling against Biden during the debate was the on Social Security, implying that you couldn't trust Joe Biden not to slash Social Security. And that seems to have gotten no traction whatsoever in Florida. So I'm, you know, we hear now that the Sanders campaign is reevaluating, but you know, if that shot doesn't move anybody, it's hard to know what could change from now on. I mean, look, this race is over, right? I mean, I don't want to, you know, dance around all of this. The Democratic primary race is over. It's just a question of, you know, of how you wrap it up, right? I mean, there's no way Sanders has anything like remotely plausible path to winning this nomination. Correct? I mean, to stipulate that,
assuming they continue to have primaries and people vote, and those people are Democrats or independents who show up to vote in the Democratic primary, then Joe Biden will be the nominee.
What if they don't have primaries though? I mean, here's like this weird world we're in. What happens if they just don't have primaries anymore?
I mean, if they go to a convention and it's undecided or, you know, nobody has the full majority, then Bernie Sanders will be defeated at the convention. And I think that was always the writing on the wall. As much as Democratic leaders were freaking out about Bernie Sanders, what seemed to be obvious, at least to me, and I think probably to a lot of other people, was that Bernie Sanders' floor and his ceiling were always about the same in terms of the percentage of the Democratic Party, or at least Democratic primary voting electorate that was behind him, which was right about 25%, and go up a little bit to 27 or 30, maybe drop down to 23. But basically, he couldn't really move the numbers one way or the other. And in a field of seven candidates, that gives him an opportunity to potentially win the nomination. In a field of two candidates, he doesn't have a prayer, and whether he gets stopped during the primary process or gets stopped at a convention, eventually it becomes a one-on-one situation. And that was going to be a problem for him. If Joe Biden had been somebody that the entire Democratic Party felt in love with, then the campaign would not have gone on for 14 or 15 months before all the Democrats swung behind him.
Yeah, you know, and the other problem,
more than it's about Joe Biden.
Well, I want to talk about why this failed, but I do have to sort of note that it's March 18th, and it's weird that we're even talking about it because it already has become kind of this footnote. Larry Sabato had an interesting tweet. He said it's official: Biden has defeated Bernie Sanders, but coronavirus has buried Bernie. The nomination battle has become a footnote in the media and in the public's mind. That's just reality. I mean, that is part of the problem, is that this story, which is so huge and bigger by the minute, just makes it almost impossible to change the dynamic. I mean, it just freezes the race. And it's hard to imagine any sort of a scenario now where Bernie's able to capture the public's imagination. So that's over. So let me ask you this. You had a very interesting analysis this morning, you know, that pointing out that Sanders, you know, pitch flopped. You know, the crisis highlighted a lot of the issues that really were central to the progressive movement. I mean, this was the moment to basically say, look, this is why we ought to go with Medicare for all. But as you point out, Bernie just got clocked yesterday. So I guess the question you ask is, so was it the message or the messenger?
Right. I mean, you've got this amazing moment where, you know, Vice President Mike Pence is worried about state waivers so that people who get food stamp benefits don't become ineligible because they're not able to go to work.
Yeah.
And you've got Steve Mnuchin working with Nancy Pelosi on legislation that expands paid leave. You've basically got Republicans in the White House, whether or not it's their first concern, it's certainly a concern that they are showing for at least a temporary sort of populism, a temporary concern for the working class and the poor in the country in this moment. And all of this points out like how much harder a healthcare crisis is, whether it's having lack of insurance, and how much harder an economic crisis is for people at the bottom. Anytime it happens, you know, not just in this virus period, and Bernie Sanders is completely incapable of making that argument in a way that Democratic primary voters, who are the most progressive of the progressive, are willing to side with him. And so it leaves you with that question. Is it that this argument is failing, or is it that Bernie Sanders is failing to make that argument effectively, or that he's the wrong avatar for the movement that he wants to lead? And I think that a lot of progressives were very disappointed in his performance. Not only do I think that, I've talked to some of them who were disappointed in his performance on Sunday because they feel like he really didn't make the case that at this moment when trillions of dollars are going out of the Treasury, it is a time to be thoughtful about how those dollars are going out of the Treasury and what can be done if you're going to reshape that much of the American economic system. What can be done to ensure that there's not greater disparity, and what can be done to maybe ensure that there's greater equality?
So here we're sitting here with these new estimates coming up about the scope of the crisis, and I certainly don't want to downplay the medical aspect of this because this is a medical crisis. But and you just mentioned the fact that we're about to have we may have a $1 trillion stimulus package. So we're hearing that Steve Mnuchin warned Republican senators the unemployment rate could spike to nearly 20% if they fail to do something. 20%. I mean, that's Great Depression levels. I mean, that's beyond anything that we've experienced in our lives. Another estimate out there is that the country is expected to lose 4.5 million travel-related jobs this year, as the coronavirus outbreak levies an $800 billion blow to the economy. That seems kind of plausible. Out of London, there's a research endorsed by the British government suggests that 2.2 million people might die in the United States. And 500,000 would die in Britain if nothing is done. Of course, we are taking steps at this point. So we're seeing these sort of horrific projections. And while you and I are talking, and of course, this could change in the next 5 minutes, but the stock market is once again down sharply. So give me some sense of what's happening on Capitol Hill, because it is this extraordinary moment where you have Republicans, many of whom got into politics or got elected during the Tea Party movement in opposition to the Obama stimulus package, now talking enthusiastically about sending out checks for $1,000 to everybody. Just send out checks, a stimulus package that went from $800 million 24 hours ago to now more than $1 trillion. So Republicans have finally found a kind of binge spending that they're in favor of. So how is this playing out, and how are Democrats and Republicans going to how are they going to compromise on this?
Well, I think first of all, I think you can't make the Republicans a monolith on this. I think there have been a lot of different ideas on the Republican side. I think one of the things you mentioned, Mnuchin going down and talking about 20% unemployment. Yesterday, he was still trying to convince Republicans to pass the first, well, I guess it's actually the second supplemental bill, but the one that he negotiated with Pelosi last week, still trying to get Senate Republicans to pass that with the expanded, expanded paid leave and the testing, the testing paid for folks, the much smaller package, much less this next one. So I think he was trying to put a little bit of a scare into the senators with that figure. But I also think that what you've got going on is political gamesmanship in a way, or at least some thinking about what the politics look like. You know, the president had wanted to eliminate the payroll tax entirely for the year, which would have cost roughly $1 trillion. And I think some of the Senate Republicans came back and said, you know, nobody gets credit for a payroll tax cut.
Because yeah, Obama didn't. Yeah.
People don't really notice it as much. Certainly, you get sort of whatever it is, the reverse of the 7% tax that you pay as an individual, you get that back in your account. It doesn't feel like a lot every two weeks, as opposed to $1,000 check, which everybody will remember. So I think there was some thought to, if you're going to start spending this money out of the Treasury, why wouldn't you do it with a check? Also, if you send $1,000 check to every adult, I think that works out to about $200 billion. It's a lot cheaper than a lot less money than doing the payroll tax cut for the entire.
Well, and the payroll tax, of course, goes to fund Social Security and Medicare. So there's a downside to all of that. I know that we're not all Andrew Yang here, because this is not permanent. But this has got to be difficult for. I mean, once the initial panic wears off, if it does, because it does feel like they're just sort of like, let's just throw as much money as we possibly can at this because it's absolutely horrific and we want to perceive to be doing something. But if you are a progressive, and this goes back to what we were talking about with Bernie Sanders, that you could spend this $1 trillion and it will go out. It looks like Republicans would like to make it a one-time shot, not fundamentally changing the safety net or the wealth, for lack of a better phrase, the welfare system in the country, without structural change. And then the country is still $1 trillion deeper in debt. The money that could have been spent on many of their projects is gone. And they haven't fundamentally changed anything. That's got to give them some pause, not to mention the more cynical calculation of recognizing that the biggest bailout could be of Donald Trump's presidency if, in fact, they do this. And if it succeeds, then Donald Trump really could turn this thing around. So I wonder if there's some real queasiness on the part of Democrats, about ways this could play out to basically save Donald Trump by doing this and or put the country so deeply in debt that many of their other wish list plans then become less and less practical.
I mean, among the smart ones, there's queasiness.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a Lucy in the football aspect of Democrats pursuing Donald Trump to the ends of the earth and not understanding the potential for the politics to flip on them, and not being smart about the ways that can happen, and not watching their sort of rear flank in their pursuit of him. Absolutely, I think there's queasiness, and you're watching this fight play out. If you pay attention to, where it's happening, so you see Elizabeth Warren put out a list yesterday of her conditions on. What she finds acceptable in terms of money going to big businesses. And she wants to see workers on corporate boards, and she wants to see a variety of other sort of conditions if businesses are going to get benefits from the government. And then you see Steve Forbes and Stephen Moore on the conservative side, along with Art Laffer, the author of The Laffer Curve, come out and say, this is not a time for the government to go out and expand welfare benefits permanently, and so you see this push and pull on the ideological sides. Grover Norquist is sitting somewhere in his office in Washington thinking like, there is an opportunity here to really, really reduce revenue to the government if we get that payroll tax cut done. And at the same time, help some of the business interests that he cares about. So there's a lot at stake right now, and it's the $1 trillion that's going to go out in this tranche of help, but it's also the lending that happens through the Fed, which is put out because of what the Fed has done, which is I think $1.5 trillion of easing or whatever you want to call it. So there's just a lot moving and a ton at stake. And at the end of all of that, the country will be better or worse in shape for handling a variety of other future crises. We already were at a point where we didn't have, in theory, didn't have a lot of tools.
Well, that's right. I mean, the bullets are gone, and there were people who were arguing, you know, warning about that, that it did, when you're running massive deficits and almost zero interest rates at a time of prosperity, what happens? What is your cushion if something goes wrong, if there's a recession or, God forbid, a crisis like this? And here we're at. I mean, it's they can't cut the interest rates any further if the recession gets deeper or we go into a depression. It seems highly unlikely that they'll be able to cut taxes if they're intending on spending this much. So
you can go to negative interest rates.
We could. You know, this may sound cynical. I just want to back up, you know, the whether it helps or hurts Trump. It's just that intriguing analysis from Politico that I quoted in my newsletter, you know, talking about, you know, that Trump has time on his side with the coronavirus spreading early in the cycle. And let me just read this and see what your take is. This week, Republican president adopted a more somber tone. Democrats are beginning to worry that he could mold the narrative to his benefit. Massive stimulus could help him in November. And they quote somebody who was a Democratic activist. The initial mishandling of the coronavirus by the government does not mean that voters will penalize Trump in November. We know we have two candidates who can pivot this generation's largest health crisis to their policy strength. But history tells us that an incumbent who steers us through a challenging time, a la Bush and 9/11, Obama and the Great Recession, are rewarded with a second term. And that's how some folks in the Trump inner circle view it. People close to the Trump campaign acknowledge that the president did not handle the response well in the opening weeks. But if the pandemic abates and the economy stabilizes by the fall, they see a scenario in which Trump comes out of the crisis, framing it as an American comeback story and positioning himself as the leader who navigated the country through a crisis. So, Jonathan, how plausible is that?
Well, I don't know. It's so predictive.
Yeah.
As to be hard to see right now, but I got to tell you, if I'm Donald Trump's campaign manager, and I'm reading that people at the White House think if we can pull out by the fall an American comeback story because the economy has stabilized and people don't blame the president for his mishandling of this for a couple of months, and if, then maybe we can turn it around and get a second term. I'm thinking to myself, maybe there's a good exit strategy for me from this job before I get blamed for whatever happens. Because, you know, this is that just the picture you just painted to me of the optimistic view from inside the White House sounds terribly pessimistic.
Yes, a little contingent, right? Well, you know, and it's also the president is really, you know, trying to rewrite history, and he's desperate to do it. You know, I mean, just yesterday, Trump claiming he always knew the coronavirus would be a pandemic. This is a pandemic. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. Well, you know, we live in an age where there's stuff on YouTube and there are sound bites and they're all over the place. We can remember what the president said and how he minimized it and how his supporters on Fox News minimize it, how they, you know, described, he didn't describe the pandemic as a hoax. He described the criticism that they hadn't reacted as a hoax, but the record is pretty dramatic. And I mean, we have the soundbite of him, you know, on, you know, January 22nd saying, you know, we ask, do you worry about a pandemic? And he says, no, not at all. We have it totally under control. So this will be hard for him, not impossible, but there is the weight of evidence. And we're getting more and more indication of just the almost government-wide incompetence. I mean, this is extraordinary. I'm trying to think of a parallel of where the government is screwed up this badly. And, of course, the easy one is Katrina. This seems to be deeper and more fundamental. And also, I think that sticks. That's hard to spin that away.
He's also going to have a structural problem in his politics, which is, as the federal government's response is questioned or seems less credible, people in some states will look to their governors who they see as more credible, which will set up against him governors for the first time in a way they really haven't been before. And that means that during this campaign season, he may actually find that he has a number of voices with credibility pushing against him, with both credibility and platforms pushing against him.
That is a great point, because one of the most dramatic things that has happened, it's been kind of a moment for federalism, you know, a shout out for federalism, that while the federal government seemed to dither and not provide leadership, you did have the states and local communities stepping up, and the little platoons of civil society taking steps. And you could certainly make the case that if we dodge the worst of this, it will not be because of Donald Trump, but because of those governors. And you're right. This is kind of the moment that they've been, you know, state governments have been in eclipse in the last few years because everything's been about the federal government in Washington. And this is kind of a, this is a revealing moment of about the way our federal system can work. And you're right. Some of those governors are going to have a great deal of credibility. And that that's something that we haven't seen recently.
And some of them have been asking the federal government for more help. And we get this, you know, we've been having this fight at the margins. I think a lot of people don't follow what's going on, but because it's meant to be coded. But if you listen to White House officials, if you listen to the president, but particularly, I would say, Vice President Pence and Mark Short, who, you know, for a long time has been Pence's top aide, but has also been an aide to President Trump at times during this administration, you'll hear them talk about federalism. And the and sort of the need to not have the federal government be overbearing on the states, to allow the states to you know, to work their magic, to not have the federal government making big decrees. And at the same time, you've got governors going on television and saying we need to have some basic standards across state lines, so that people aren't shopping for shopping for the state they want to be in to do the activity that they want to do that helps spread the virus, or state shopping in terms of what medical care they're going to get. And so it is an interesting clash that's going on right now, sort of below the surface, that I think at some point will become, hopefully the governments all work together perfectly and everything turns out with the most efficiently possible, but we seem to be headed for some conflict between the governors and the federal.
Though that is fascinating. You know, I mentioned before we talked about some of the potential risk for the Democrats. I mean, there's real potential risk for your what used to be Tea Party Republicans as well, voting for this kind of spending package. But more specifically, there's going to be an interesting debate about the nature of the bailouts and whether the aid should go to the workers and the lower income people who are really vulnerable, or to the corporations. I think that there's real danger. And I'm just not sure how Nancy Pelosi is going to finesse this, or how a lot of Republicans are going to finesse this. I just can't imagine that many of even Trump's core constituents are going to look with favor on major corporate bailouts, cash bailouts to companies, particularly things like the, you know, casino, if there's casino bailouts, or, you know, airline bailouts, if they feel that the money has not gone to the people who actually need it. And that's going to be difficult, because you know that, you know, Trump's instincts are to take care of his friends. You know, despite all this populist bullshit, you know, he is the ultimate crony capitalist. And some of that, I think, could just generate a massive blowback if people think that the average worker is being screwed while he's taking care of major companies that, you know, are taking a hit to their bottom line. I mean, and we saw, you know, how much of the political, the political reaction to that was after the Obama years. But now it's hard for me to figure out how do you do it if both Democrats and Republicans have to vote for this package? You follow what I'm getting at here? I mean, Republicans made Obama own everything in the past, but if they share it, I don't know how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's I agree with you. I think that's a much more difficult cat to skin. I don't know. I don't want to get animal rights activists mad at me.
It's okay. We're cats. You know, we're dog people here.
but yeah, I think that's problematic in terms of getting the both sides on board. You know, one of the things that I have found interesting is, or that I think is interesting going forward is, you know, there's always this sort of black and white question of, are you helping the little guy? Are you helping the corporation? And the truth is that those aren't, you know, that all these decisions are probably best made in some sort of, at some sort of like individual case level or in the various areas of gray, right? Like different companies operate in different ways. If companies go down, so do jobs for employees, right? So the little guy loses his job anyway. And so you, ideally you would have policies that actually work to both keep companies alive and keep workers from losing their jobs and keep and allow workers to take paid sick leave where they need to so that they're not infecting other people. I mean, here we've elected all these people to make these decisions. And so frequently what their answer is, well, we're going to do the thing that is most politically palatable, which is to kind of have a broad brush approach and then let the details kind of be filled in. And sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't, but
yeah.
You know, I look at, you mentioned the airline industry. There are a lot of people who are mad at them because all of their profits go into stock buybacks. Yep. So if that's the case and you want to bail out the airline industry, I know Warren has put together a proposal that basically says, if you get bailout money, you can't do stock buybacks. Like maybe that's, you know, I don't know if that's the right policy or not. I'm not an expert on it, but like, there are people who are thinking about like, how do you actually make specific policies that make sense to help keep companies?
Yeah, this is complicated. I mean, the way you're describing it, you know, would require a really careful balancing and an understanding of the unintended consequences and the possible downsides of these moves. If they are rushing this through, I mean, you know, Mnuchin was talking about getting packages through by the end of the week, checks out by the end of the month. This is what worries me is that when you have politicians acting with debt finance panic, bad things happen. They don't take the time to think through what they are doing, and the consequences are going to be long term. Now, you mentioned something that I want to at least put a pin in is the. You know, a crisis like this changes something fundamentally. I mean, this is going to be a shock to the political system, is a shock to the economic system. We are going to see, you look historically, we seldom emerge from a crisis unchanged. The attitude towards sick pay and sick leave, I think, is something to watch here. Because when we start thinking through the millions of Americans that have no sick pay, that have a tremendous incentive to show up to work ill because they have no alternative, and the number of companies that are extremely profitable that do not provide sick pay or sick leave, you know, my guess is that the political environment on that issue is going to change and will change fundamentally. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, look, the first thing everybody figured out with this virus is that no matter how rich you are, if somebody shows up to your workplace who's sick, you can get sick. And yeah. That's why you saw such a rush to make sure that people could get tested for free. They're not moving to make sure that people get treated for free.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but that's the, you know, I was
reading. I hate to put it that cynically, Charlie, but no. I mean, the right. Is to stop the disease from spreading, and you know there was, and the treatment obviously is much more expensive, but testing is important for everybody, for the entire population, and that's how you cut it down. So I kid a little bit about the intent there, but
I don't think you're kidding. I don't think you're gonna be too cynical about that.
Well, I mean we know that the testing is, for the entire population, the testing is flat out important, right? I mean, you can contain this. If you tested everybody, you would be able to contain this very quickly. And so the testing is the most important thing, regardless of any other incentives or factors. And the treatment is extremely expensive. And so there's a reason that they did that But I do think that this has made people realize that if someone comes to work sick, if the if I come to work sick, the CEO of the company that I work for can
get sick.
Can get sick and give it to his grandmother, and his grandmother can die. And that has nothing to do with whether they're poor or wealthy. Now, she might get better treatment. She might have a better chance, but she'll get the sickness in the first place. And so,
well, you know, and what really struck me when I was like, I think it was the New York Times that did this analysis of who doesn't have sick pay or sick leave. And it's heavily concentrated in the restaurant and food service industry, which is exactly the people that you would want to not come in when they're, you know, hacking up a lung or sneezing and those sorts of things. So that's, I do think that we're sort of on the precipice of rethinking those issues. And that actually may be on a bipartisan basis, because that strikes me as a common sense solution that once we enact it, there's still that knee jerk thing, you know, don't impose. And I, by the way, when I say knee jerk, these are the arguments that I would have made a few years ago. Don't impose more regulations on business. This should be something that should be decided by the private sector. But, you know, when we're dealing with something like this, a pandemic, a public health issue, you realize it's not a simply private matter. It does affect people so widely. And I think that's also going back to your piece about Bernie Sanders, you know, not being able to make the case. You know, this is a moment, quite frankly, to make the case for collective action. And I say this as kind of a libertarian conservative, that I recognize that right now there don't appear to be any libertarians out there. There, you know, the entire focus is on our collective responsibility and the collective, need to have a collective agenda in dealing with these social problems. So we'll have to see here.
You could be a libertarian and understand that there are limits to libertarianism, and you could be a conservative and understand there are limits to that, and be sure. Progressive and understand there are limits to that. And I think to me, what this all points to is what we're watching. What it points to is maybe sometimes, you know, the need to not always look at each other as being malign. And so if you are a worker, not always looking at the corporation as malign, if you're a corporation, not always looking at the worker as malign, not always looking at somebody and saying they're going to try to get away with as much as they possibly can. And, you know, think that if there's sick leave, that somebody's going to take advantage of that every single time, or that if the corporation has some opportunity, that they're always going to avail themselves of it in a way that is not beneficial to the worker, and that maybe you build in incentives for people to not take advantage of you. But there, you know, maybe we try to build a society that's like a little bit less in a place where we all think that everybody else is terrible if they're not on our side.
This is a really interesting point, because you're basically saying let's move away from us versus them. But up until 5 minutes ago, that's the way our politics was trending. Everything was us versus them. And this is kind of an interesting simulation, because we were at this moment of absolute maximum partisan toxicity at the end of January, right? With the impeachment, everything that was going on here, getting into the 2020 election, where everyone had an incentive to play the us versus them. And now we have to figure out whether we can still work together. And that's really kind of amazing. I mean, if somebody wrote this script, Jonathan, you know, if in your next life you become a script writer, or you're, you know, writing the miniseries and something, the producers would say this is implausible, you know, to go from this to forcing everybody to work together. But I don't know. I guess I'd watch it. Well, we have no choice, because we have to watch it now, right?
It's like a Twilight Zone episode where you know, coronavirus has been sent to see if we are worth saving, and at the end, when we decide to work together, you know, God or the aliens that sent it or whatever decide that because we've decided to work together instead of killing each other, we're not worth saving.
We are being tested. It's sort of like, okay, you people have gotten totally out of hand now. So let's have an intervention from reality. Let's see how you handle reality, something that can't be spun or tweeted away, and we'll have to see. You know, it's we live in an age where we overhype everything, right? Everything is overhyped. This, however, and I may regret saying this, I'm trying to think, you know, outside of a world war, when did we encounter a crisis like this? 9/11 was at this level, but it didn't have the universal effect that this has. This feels, and I don't, I'm trying to avoid the word unprecedented or unique, but I'm going to fail there because this does feel really unprecedented in terms of just wake up every day and finding out Las Vegas has shut down. I mean, I thought it was a big deal when South by Southwest was shut down. I thought it was unbelievable when March Madness shuts down. But every day brings another one of those stories.
It's a sustained, I hate to use the term attack.
Yeah.
The virus is not, thinking like a, like an enemy in that way. But it is essentially a sustained attack on our homeland, which we have not had in any of our lifetimes. Right. I mean, Pearl Harbor was a quick strike on our homeland. 9/11 was a quick strike on our homeland. Not since the British invaded have we had an external force with a sustained attack on our homeland. And this is, as the president has called it, an invisible enemy. But more than that, it's something that is completely unpredictable to us. It's unpredictable to the experts.
It's everywhere. I mean, it's not just in one place. It is just everywhere. And like, we're all sitting here in home. I'm at home. You're at home. Millions of Americans are at home. Schools are being canceled for the rest of the year. Okay. So I have to ask you this question, Jonathan. Can you imagine, you remember when you were in like sixth or seventh grade? Can you remember that far back?
Yes. 100 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. So if somebody would have come in and said, "Hey, Jonathan, school is canceled for the rest of the year," would that have been, "Oh, I'm really disappointed," or, "Oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever"?
Oh, totally the greatest thing ever.
I think so too. I'm sure there are other people that, "Oh, I'm going to miss my friends," or, "I'm not going to get to go to the prom," or everything. I'm thinking, are you kidding me? There is like the ultimate snow day times a million.
There is no year of education that I had where I would not have had that feeling up through college.
I might have felt this way. I agree with you. I'm thinking whether there was an exception, maybe in my senior year of high school. No, you know what? Especially like right now, it's spring and you don't have to go back to school at all.
Although I completely understand the teenagers that are marauding through the streets at odds with the recommendations. I mean, I understand being 17 or 18 and thinking you're invincible and not listening
to anyone
else and wanting to be with your friends. And not that I approve of it, but I definitely understand it.
Well, except that, I'm older than you, but I mean, there was a time that if we had been quote unquote quarantined or, had to shelter in place, we had a phone. And you had a television set that played really crappy stuff during the day. We are able to be more connected. So, my sympathy.
Do you have a party line, Charlie?
No, I did. No, I think we were past that. But it was one phone. So if I was on the phone, nobody could get a phone call in the house. Remember that?
Yeah.
There are things that you think back on and you go, "Wow, we actually lived through that." Do you know that in my lifetime, people were allowed to smoke on an airplane? Which seems insane. You're in a tube and they're smoking.
You could smoke in hospitals.
I know, what about the oxygen? Yeah, can I use your oxygen? Well, or they get one phone line, and if somebody's on AOL, well, that's later. I mean, one phone line, and it's like your parents couldn't get a call. They couldn't make a call. You were just shut off from the entire world. So I'm sorry about the 17-year-olds marauding, but they have smartphones, they have the internet, they have virtual reality come on, people. I mean, you have Netflix, you have all of these things, you can get stuff delivered to your house. So in terms of the moment in history where we could survive this, well, we're living in it right now, but again, we don't know where we're going to go. Jonathan Allen, see, obviously, since I'm wandering here, we're done, right? We're out of material.
I guess so. I mean, I'm always happy to talk with you, Charlie.
All right. Well, you stay healthy. You keep your family healthy, and try not to go out to the bars this weekend.
I will not be going out to any bars. smoking cigars in the backyard.
Jonathan Allen, senior political analyst for NBC News. Again, thank you so much for all of your time.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.